Our topic today is the evolution of the human brain, how the modern human brain came into existence, how the way it developed influenced the way it functions, and thus the way we function, and whether it's still evolving. I have with me in the studio three academics who've considered this issue from a variety of perspectives. Clark Barrett is an assistant professor at the Department of Anthropology at UCLA. He studied the links between children's cognitive development and evolution, as well as the way cognition varies across cultures as a way of assessing what aspects of it are universal. Michael Arbib is the Fletcher Jones Professor of Computer Science, as well as a Professor of Neuroscience and Psychology at the University of Southern California. As his title suggests, he's particularly interested in the relationship between brains and machines, but he's also using his insights into the monkey brain to develop a new theory of the evolution of human language. Craig Stanford is Professor of Anthropology and Biological Sciences and co-director of the Jane Goodall Research Center at the University of Southern California. A specialist in the fields of great ape behavior and human origins, he's well known for his groundbreaking work on the meat-eating behavior of wild chimpanzees, conducted in collaboration with Dr. Jane Goodall. I'd like to start off by discussing the first apes that could be described as walking apes, the Australopithecines, which appeared about 4.4 million years ago. Craig Stanford, how would you describe the brain possessed by our Australopithecine ancestors in terms of how big it was, what it allowed them to do, how they behaved?
I think the best way to look at an Australopithecine in general is to think of them as being bipedal, upright walking apes, as you said. I mean, they were the earliest hominid ancestors, meaning they share a common ancestor with us, and we both share a common ancestor with the ancestors of the great apes, the ancestors of modern chimps, gorillas, and so forth. Brain-wise, their brains were incrementally larger than those of modern great apes, but not dramatically so. And if the organization of their brains was very different from that of the modern great apes, we don't see that very well in the fossils that we have. In other words, they probably had brains that were quite like those of great apes, scaled larger because their bodies were slightly larger than those of great apes. It's not really until we see much, much more recent human ancestors that we begin to see the mushrooming exponentially larger brains that begin to resemble our own.
How do their brains relate, for example, to those of chimpanzees?
Well, in terms of volume, which is really all we can say, because in a fossil we just can measure or estimate the volume of the brain by having the skull. We know that a male chimpanzee's brain volume is something like 350 to 400 cubic centimeters. And that of an Australopithecine is, depending on the species we're talking about, something like 450 to 550 cubic centimeters. So it's not that much larger.
Is that the brain that's been sort of roughly described as the one pint brain?
Yes, well, just for a point of reference, a modern human brain volume of you or me might be something on the order of 1,400 to 1,500 cubic centimeters. So it's still only about a third the size of our brain overall. And the neocortex, which is the meat of the brain in terms of higher cognition, is not really very impressive in an Australopithecine. It's very ape-like.
What can we say about the way they behaved and whether their behavior patterns suggest any difference in the kind of brain they had?
Well, I really am not an expert on Australopithecines. What I've been doing is focusing on basically a three-point comparison, the macaque monkey, the chimpanzee, and the human, where we can look at their modern behavior and try to step back to infer what happened at crucial ancestral points. So we think it's about 20 million years ago that the monkeys split off from the line that became the apes and ourselves. And what we see there is that communication, since I'm interested in language, communication is limited to a very small repertoire of calls, things like, oh, there's a leopard, let's run up a tree, and things of this kind. And those calls seem to be stereotyped. A young monkey can learn how to use the call. Don't just do it for anything flying overhead if it's the eagle call. Don't just use it for anything skulking along the ground if it's the leopard call. But they can't make up new calls. Whereas when we turn to the apes, and we see our common ancestor at perhaps 5 million rather than 20 million years ago with the apes, we begin to see a variety of communicative gestures, now in the manual domain, not the vocal domain. And if we compare two different communities of apes of the same species, we might find that each has a repertoire of 20 or so gestures, but maybe only 10 overlap between the two, suggesting some aspect of local ritualization and conventionalization and social learning. And that seems to suggest that perhaps amongst the non-human primates, the use of gesture rather than the use of voice is closer to the sort of innovations that occurred in the brain as we move towards language. And the one other big differentiator of the three groups that we've been studying in terms of modern brain mechanisms to thus infer back to the ancestors is that monkeys have very, very little capability for imitation. Chimps can imitate, but it may take, in general, many repetitions, and the imitation seems to be more in terms of objects in relation to other objects or themselves, whereas humans have a more symbolic type of imitation. They can look at a behavior, break it into its parts, get the picture, and apply that. So from the brain point of view, I haven't been looking at the fossil record, where I don't have anything, as we've heard, beyond the skull size, basically. But I have been looking at modern species where we can correlate these differences in behavior with differences in actual brain mechanism, and then we make rather daring, but I think justified, assumptions about what is in common between different species as an indicator of what might have been present in the ancestor 20 million years ago, the ancestor 5 million years ago.
Clark Barrett, what do your studies of the way that children develop tell you about the probable brain activities of our earliest ancestors?
Well, we modern humans have a variety of, one might call them, specialized cognitive abilities that are probably shared widely across all primates and mammals. So things like predator detection abilities, the ability to recognize the faces of conspecifics, and those kinds of things are universal in humans and probably also shared across many, many species. What's interesting about humans compared to other kinds of primates, even our closest ancestors, chimpanzees, is the very long juvenile period that we have. So learning is a much more important thing. And human children are immature, in a sense, for a much longer period of time than other animals. And that probably has to do with the acquisition of culturally transmitted information and skills like hunting skills and things like that. Well, there would have been hunting skills in many ancestral humans, but now that long juvenile period allows us to acquire lots and lots of the cultural expertise that we get.
Now, do we have any reason to think that if we go back to the Australopithecines, that juvenile period was any longer than it would have been for chimps? That is to say, you know, if their brains were no bigger, then presumably the birthing process and the growing up process would have been pretty similar to the past.
There are some ways, of course, it's difficult to know for sure. There are some ways to know through a kind of indirect inference what the developmental trajectory would have been. For example, teeth eruption patterns. You can compare how teeth erupt. Teeth is one of the things that we preserve well, so that we have teeth of Australopithecines and the various other kinds of hominin ancestors. And it's probably the case, comparing the tooth eruption patterns of chimps and modern humans and what we see in Australopithecines, that the Australopithecines didn't have that much longer of a developmental period than chimps did.
Yeah, I think we could say it's intermediate in some way. We just don't know how intermediate.
Probably intermediate.
And probably some key answers will come about from this discovery that was announced only in the past few months of the Dikika child, so-called, this toddler-aged Australopithecine discovered in Ethiopia, presumed to be a member of the same species that Lucy is a member of, Australopithecus afarensis. And being a toddler, we're going to learn just a treasure trove of developmental information about that species and about early humans in general. It's really remarkable to find a full skeleton of a very immature individual of that species, and it's just going to be a goldmine of information.
What I'd like to establish, though, before we move on from Australopithecus, is to the extent to which the behaviors that early species showed differ from those of the primates that came before. What did that ancestor of ours do that the creatures before didn't?
Well, there's several things. One thing that we can infer pretty well is what their diet was like, which I would probably leave to Craig, as he's more of an expert on that. There's other things, like we know that there was a greater degree of sexual dimorphism between males and females in Australopithecines than in modern humans.
Now let's just spell that out.
Which means they were overall, their bodies were smaller than modern humans. However, relatively speaking, male Australopithecines were much bigger than female Australopithecines. Well, the difference between their sizes was much greater, relatively speaking, than the difference between males and females in modern humans.
Now, does that suggest a certain kind of society, a certain kind of male dominance, or what does it tell us about this, the way they lived?
Well, I think that most biologists would make the inference from that, making the comparison to other species in which there's a large degree of sexual dimorphism, that there was a fair amount of male competition between males for access to females. We don't know necessarily what that says about the structure of their societies in ways other than mating, but probably there was a lot more competition between males for females than there is in modern humans, which means the flip side of that is that there's probably a much greater degree of pair bonding or monogamy in modern humans than there was in Australopithecines.
So they probably, a dominant male had impregnated a significant proportion of the women in the group, females in the group.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Craig, your thoughts on the question of diet?
Well, I'd agree that we can learn only limited information from the fossils because, of course, we can't put flesh on them literally, and we're always speculating a little bit. But the one thing I would point to is posture and the way of getting around. The most dramatic change in our bodies from the non-human primate ancestors that we share with living apes and ourselves was that our ancestors became, around 6 million years ago, bipeds. They began to move upright. They may have begun to move upright in trees before coming to the ground. We don't know the exact sequence or timeline, but we know that by 5 to 6 million years ago, they were able-bodied walkers on the ground, utilizing the ground. And that made a dramatic shift, made for a dramatic shift in the way we do things. It meant that eventually we were more efficient at traveling on open ground. It may have changed the way that males related to other males. It may have changed the way that we procured food. And so that, I mean, we often talk about the brain. It's certainly dramatically important. It's a glamorous and kind of sexy thing for us to dwell on, but it is certainly true that the earliest feature of our lineage that made us human was actually our posture, meaning our hips changed, the structure of our lower body from the waist down changed, and the brain size didn't really change at that early, early time. It changed much, much later than that for reasons that might not be closely connected to the way we stand up and move around.
Would you concur with that, Michael?
Well, one of the follow-ons from that fascinates me is the idea that increased bipedalism freed up the hands, and that gave us more manual dexterity, which created the opportunity for skill acquisition that was not there before, and that gave a selective advantage to a brain that could imitate. And these seem to be the ingredients that come together to provide the basis for later development of communication systems and of language. So I think that bipedalism is sort of, in that sense, a key transition because it allows the upper body to do things that are there. You can see them in the great apes today, but not there in the same extent. And I just want to return to one earlier point about childhood development, that what we have to look at is not only the evolution of the child's ability to learn, but also the evolution of the adult's ability to care for the child. And I don't know what it's like in the wild, but Tomasello, who's an expert on studying groups of chimpanzees in zoos and place like that, observes the difference between the mother chimpanzee who will passively allow the child to take some food and the human mother who is actively engaging the child in shared attention to discuss the food and what it means and things of this kind. So I think that what we see is this sort of progression. There's the change in the bipedalism that opens up new types of communication, and that opens up new types of social structure, to some extent culturally evolved, to some extent biologically based, which in turn allow a catalytic process.
Then there's the question of tools, the tools and what the tools allowed Australopithecus to do and to eat. Thoughts on that?
Well, we actually have very little tool evidence for Australopithecines. Most of the tool evidence we have begins at about 2.5 million years ago because we begin to find stone tools in the fossil record, And we also find cut marks made on fossilized animal bones that were very clearly made by these human-made stone tools. And for the most part, and in fact, the reason I spent so many years studying meat-eating in wild chimps was that before 2.5 million years ago, we are essentially pre-archaeological. That is, there is no evidence for material remains of humans. And so in order to get a window onto the behavior of what those very early humans, hominids, may have done, I looked at modern chimps because they eat a lot of meat, but they eat it in very small packages, meaning small animals and baby monkeys and piglets, and they catch it not using weapons, not using tools, but by hand. And there's no question, I think. I mean, it seems common sense that the earliest hominids, before they had much technology at all, would have done essentially the same thing. Now, one really important difference that maybe links up what we're saying here between humans and apes is that chimpanzees do not go out into the forest in the morning searching for meat. They don't go out searching for these high-quality foods that contain animal fats and lots of protein and things that are good to eat. They go out looking for fruit and leaves and flowers. And in the course of their day, if they encounter a pig who has a litter of piglets hidden in the leaf litter or a group of monkeys, they may hunt and catch some good source of animal fat and protein, but they don't expend all that energy looking for the meat, presumably because they walk around on all fours, and it's not a very efficient way to get around relative to our bipedal walking. And if they fail to get meat on a given day, they're going to be energy stressed after a day or two of doing that. We, on the other hand, we meaning traditional people living in traditional societies like hunter-gatherers, will go out. Men will go out looking for meat, clearly hunting. And in the course of that search, they'll also gather honey or grubs or insects and plant parts. They'll eat other things. But it's clear that they're out looking for meat. And they can tell you that, of course, which chimps can't. They can tell you we're looking for meat and we're collecting other good things along the way. And that difference from that change from opportunism to intentionality, I think, is really critical in human evolution. And it has a lot to do with the way we get around, that we can move very efficiently on two legs. And as Michael said earlier, that really has made for the opportunity to have your hands free and be technological. And it also is just an efficient way to get around and saves you energy for other important things.
I want to ask you a question, though, Craig. In the car on the way here, you mentioned this new video from the Congo of tool use with pieces of wood, so by chimpanzees. Could you just recall that in relation to what might have been easier tool use, opportunistic tool use with wood and things of that kind, which wouldn't presumably add much to the fossil record?
Yeah, I was saying that a colleague had shown me recently a video in which we know chimps use wooden tools. They use sticks to probe for termites and termite mounds. But this was a new piece of video that it was just made recently of chimps surrounding a termite mound in a forest in Central Africa, and a big male chimp taking a very large stick that was a wide diameter stick, and then putting his foot on the end of it, just like you might put your foot on the metal part of a shovel when you're trying to drive it into the garden, and pushing it into this concrete hard earthen termite mound, breaking it open so that then they could get inside and get whatever goodies were inside. And so, yes, I mean, very clearly, our ancestors were, I would assume, using wooden implements for getting food long before stone tools appear in the fossil record at 2.5 million. We don't have any evidence of that, and we never will, most likely, because wood doesn't fossilize very well. And so that's why I studied modern chimps, because it's a window onto what they may have done.
One interesting thing about tools that we see through studies of modern human cognition, both in adults and in very young children, it's a recent area of investigation in cognitive development, looking at how children learn about tools and also comparing to other species of primates. It seems very natural. We're very natural tool users, and so it seems intuitively obvious to us when we look at something like a hammer that the hammer is for hammering things in, or that a screwdriver is for turning screws. We learn very quickly the specific functions that are associated with particular tools. And that seems to be, to some degree, categorically different for other kinds of primates, where they're able to use tools and they're able to learn how to use tools, but they don't rapidly associate a particular function with a particular tool. And that's something that humans do very readily, and children do quite readily. And there's actually an interesting effect in cognitive psychology called functional fixedness, where knowing the use of a tool makes it more difficult to imagine alternative possible uses. And That may be the sort of flip side, the downside of this specialization that we have for using tools. And it turns out that very young children aren't as susceptible to that. They can actually envision different possible uses for tools much more easily than adults can, perhaps because they haven't quite, it hasn't quite solidified in their brain that a hammer is for hammering things, for example.
Can I go on to this question of how this change in diet, this amount of meat that we were now eating in increasing quantities, would probably have affected the growth in brain size? Because I understand the brain is a fairly expensive organ for the body to have in terms of its energy use.
Well, I think there are two factors here. Most people who have been interested in diet and brain size increases throughout evolution have focused on one thing, which is that, hey, you eat good food, highly nutritious food, and then it's easier to grow a metabolically expensive organ like a brain. And there may well be something very important there, that when you begin to eat increasing animal fat in your diet, which we all think of as being terrible for us, but of course in a historical wider context, it's a wonderful nutrient source. That may be well be important, but there's another aspect to meat eating and brain size increase that I focus on in my own work, which is that when you acquire meat and you're a species in which it's very hard to acquire meat, chimps live in a forest surrounded by plant foods, but getting animal fat and protein is really difficult. It involves a risky hunt. You may be bitten by the animal you're hunting. You may fail most of the time. Females tend not to do it, maybe because it's dangerous to their infants they're carrying on their chests. So they end up essentially begging for meat from males. And all of this nature of this commodity exchange and the fact that meat is a commodity suggests that it may have played a role in the evolution of social behavior, meaning it becomes something that can be used for barter. We see male chimps in the wild commonly using meat as a political tool. They give it to their allies to cement those alliances. They withhold it from their rivals publicly to snub their rivals. They give it to females they'd like to have sex with. It is part of their social arena, in addition to being, of course, a really important nutritional item. So my way of seeing this is that meat was critically important, not only because of its pure nutritional value, but because it plays into the social arena.
It seems to me that a lot of biological anthropologists are converging on a view that all of these different factors, meat eating, long juvenile periods for acquisition of hunting skills, increased sociality, increased pair bonding, which was associated also with greater paternal investment, greater investment by fathers and offspring, all these things are intertwined in a kind of co-evolutionary process where none of them necessarily came first before the other, but they all created a kind of synergy that allowed the evolutionary trajectory that we see towards modern humans to have occurred, with large brains, greater sociality, and all these factors evolving really together.
Do you see it that way, Michael?
Sure. but I just want to return again to that point about this included, this paternal or maternal investment included this much greater sharing of attention and caregiving for the child. And we were talking earlier about tool use. One of my colleagues, Pat Zuko of Goldring, has been looking at how children learn a variety of skills and trying to spell out the ways in which the adult can help the child by saying, this is what you pay attention to in terms of what it is about the object that affords a behavior, but also what is it about your hands that allow you to do things. And so, for example, just peeling an orange. The child already knows that, hey, if that peel comes off, there's going to be some nice fruit. But how does it learn how to actually get the peel off? And so the caregiver starts with starting to remove the peel. So the easy thing of getting the peel off once it's started can be acquired. And then the child, knowing that part, can then focus in on the hard part, which is to get through the pith to get the piece going. So again and again, I think we see that this dynamic is one that goes back and forth in this synergy that we've just heard about, in which you get the social aspect, not only in terms of people interacting as adults, but in terms of adults taking a much greater interest in the young. And so presumably, yes, you get that co-evolution of an extended period of helplessness, because there is a system in place to use that period to provide adaptive skills, rather than it just being, I got to look after the kid longer. And I wonder if I could just come back to Craig with a question about meat eating and supporting a big brain. I mean, it seems to me, although I may be wrong, that supporting the body of a large silverback gorilla with a small brain would not be less than supporting a human with a highly metabolic brain. So do you have any thoughts about that trade-off and what it means?
Well, I mean, first what I would say, one of the most remarkable observations one can make is that although we're all obsessed with cholesterol and saturated fat, the fact is that as a species, there's a lot of good suggestive evidence that we are actually highly immune to the harmful effects of saturated fat and cholesterol. We live in this kind of toxic environment where we can eat meat every day and eggs every day if we choose to, and then we will have problems, especially if we're middle-aged or older men. But throughout most of human history, those were very limited commodities. And there's a lot of suggestive evidence, and I would bet that someone will at some point discover a gene or a gene complex that conferred on our ancestors. In fact, a colleague of mine at USC, Caleb Finch, and I have written about this, that conferred on our ancestors the ability to make use of fat and meat without so many of the harmful effects. But when we turn to the great apes, and you're mentioning this issue of gorillas and chimps, when we turn to the great apes, we don't find that. We find that, for instance, gorillas in the wild don't touch meat, essentially. We find that gorillas kept in zoos, which traditionally were fed an ounce of beef a day or an egg a day because it was thought to be healthy, tend to suffer heart disease as young adults. And so zoos around the world have stopped doing that. And so there is some evidence, I think, that humans have just a basically different physiology from the great apes and probably related to the tremendous benefits of meat consumption. And I would agree that part of that is that eating a really good fat-rich diet and protein-rich diet is good for growing expensive organs like brains.
Here's the thing that fascinates me. You talk about this combination of the physical changes in terms of, for example, bipedalism and then the difference in caring for the children and so on and so forth. But that produced not just, quotes, a more effective society, but also, apparently, the physical change of the brain expanding in size significantly at a certain period in human history. I mean, a massive increase in brain size. Do we understand why that came about? Because the Australopithecines went around, managed with this one-pint brain, and then suddenly it goes to what you might roughly describe as a two-pint brain.
Before we answer that, I would just add that it appears to me, and I think it appears to most people from the fossil record, that the increase in brain size is incremental and pretty much scales to an increase in body size of these early ancestors for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So meaning when we look at something like Homo erectus, which is an ancient ancestor, but still would clearly be identifiable as human. I mean, we're talking about a relatively tall, 5.5 to 6 feet tall in some cases, human being that was of an earlier species than we are. And yet their brain sizes, which were about a third smaller than ours, seem to have been more or less scaled through human history, through their history, to body size. And only when we get to a very recent time of a few hundred thousand years ago do we see the brain just blossom, the cortex of the brain, and body size being essentially modern or almost modern. So that's the question. And I don't have a good answer to that. Maybe Michael or Clark would. But throughout the rest, the earlier part of human history that I'm more familiar with and work in because those ancestors were much more ape-like, I think what we see really is brains that simply scaled to the size of the body. That was a very logical sort of a brain size increase.
Any thoughts on that as to whether the
Well, returning to what I said about the sort of synergistic effects of all of these changes happening during the human lineage, I think that there has been a tendency in anthropology to try to find a single cause and to say this is the thing that happened, which then led in a cause and effect chain to greater brain volume, and I think that that's probably not the right way of thinking about it. Every time that someone has suggested something like that, it's turned out to be a lot more complicated than that. So for example, people wondered, there was this classic question about the relationship between bipedalism and brain volume. And the dramatic increase in brain volume that we see beyond what you would expect for body size happened well after millions of years after bipedalism. So bipedalism occurred, even the earliest hominin fossils that we have, there's evidence for bipedalism based on the hole at the base of the skull where the spinal cord comes out, even in specimens that are somewhere around 5 to 6 million years old, they were probably bipedal but had very small brains. And that that obviously wasn't directly the cause, although it could have there could have been some later cascading effects. I think instead it's better to think about these various changes occurring gradually, relatively gradually and simultaneously, changes in behavior, increased provisioning, which required increased hunting. So there were behavioral effects happening that would select for a longer juvenile period and so on. So there was no single cause that really you can identify, pinpoint as the prime mover in the increase in brain size. Instead, it was a co-evolutionary thing where many traits co-evolved at the same time.
I would point to, at least people in my field who work with great apes and other primates, we often point to three different possible categories of factors that might have led to brain size increase. One of them is technological. That is, that when our ancestors began using tools, there was a premium placed on being a good tool maker, a good tool user, and that may have contributed to increase in brain size. Another is environmental or ecological, and that is that when you live in a complex habitat, navigating through it and especially remembering where things are, having an outstanding spatial cognition, that may have contributed to an increase in brain complexity and brain size. And then the third, which is probably the currently most important and most used school of thought about the increase in brain size, is social, which is pretty much what we've been talking about. And that is that as our societies became more complex, and what I really mean by that is when our group size became bigger, when we began living in groups that maybe instead of being 10, were in the dozens or 100 or 150, then that puts a premium on being able to navigate not the physical environment, but your social milieu, and being able to understand what someone else wants, being able to manipulate others. We all know that being a politician means you have to read someone else's mind and be able to get someone else to do something they don't know you're manipulating them to do. And that places a premium on being very smart. So the social intelligence, as it's called, school of thought, is really has primacy, I think, these days, at least in the field of animal behavior and human origins.
Michael, I wonder if you could comment on something that's always fascinated me when I've been reading accounts of the way that the human brain has evolved, that there seems often to be a lag between changes in behavior and increases in the size of the brain. That is to say, it often seems that you move from the 1-pint brain to the 2-pint brain or to the 3-pint brain, but it's not as though you suddenly start seeing more sophisticated tools or very different behaviors as far as we can reveal. I mean, is that your understanding? Does it surprise you if that is the case?
Let me take that in a few stages. I'd like to go first to the observation commonly made that our DNA overlaps that of the chimpanzee for 99%, more or less. And people usually find that really amazing. And they think, my God, we're so much more intelligent than the chimps. We should only have 50% overlap of DNA. But just think, for example, about your hand and compare it to the hand of a chimpanzee. Now, by the time you've specified the genes for making the bones and the tendons and the muscles and the skin and the hair and the fingernails, adding a few bits to change the relative opposability and size of the thumb is not such a big deal. So that's the first point, that there can be changes that require relatively small changes in the DNA, but once they've occurred, can have huge implications. So the opposable thumb, maybe the people who had opposable thumbs were better at stripping leaves off branches, and that was enough to give them a selective advantage. But once that was in place, it required proto-humans, to discover ways to exploit that. And some of those happen immediately, and some of those take a long time. So one of our current debates is, did the evolution of the early human brain of, let's say, 150,000 years ago, was that selective specifically for language? Or was it that it gave us perhaps social interaction, the ability to interact with social complexity, the ability to learn new skills, enough to provide a selective advantage for that group, but not giving us modern skills? So, for example, suppose language depending on who you talk to, language was sort of there for the first humans, or language emerged about 90,000 years ago as a human discovery based on earlier forms of simpler communication called proto-language. But look at modern humans. Most of us take writing for granted, and we can't imagine most of us being human without writing. Perhaps some of us can't even imagine being human without iPods. But the point is that writing is only a few thousand years ago. Living in cities is only a few thousand years ago. Agriculture is only a few thousand years ago. So that language is so much part of the way we think of being human, it's hard to imagine not having it. But in fact, a lot of things may be discoveries of this kind. So I think part of our what I find in my language evolution community to be a problem is a lot of people are unable to imagine being a proto-human, and therefore they start postulating that we evolved for these very complex things rather than evolving things that gave us a selective advantage. And the last point I'd make about that is that when we talk about evolution, we have the danger of falling into the trap of saying that evolution was towards humans and that humans are the peak of evolution. But really, evolution is not about who is better on an absolute scale. Evolution is just about, can you make enough of a living to have kids who can in turn make a living? And until recently, there was a very nice living to be made in the jungle in ways that were not very comfortable for humans. And humans could go off in a different direction with their increased group size and hunting and so on and make a living in a different way.
Any thoughts, Clark and Craig, about this issue of what that struck me as the lag between increases in brain size and changes in behaviour, which applies, I think, to modern humans, but also to species in the past?
Well, it's difficult to say. One reason is because there are relatively few general evolutionary laws about the speed at which evolutionary change can happen. So we know, for example, that evolution by natural selection and also evolution by random changes in the genome happens faster when you have smaller population sizes, for example. So you could have very, very rapid evolution would have been possible during some of the phases of human evolution when probably population sizes were quite a bit smaller. It's difficult to say also because the behavior itself doesn't fossilize, it's difficult to say to what degree changes in gross brain structure, brain volume, correlated with changes in behavior at the time. We don't know. And Craig pointed to the fact that only certain kinds of tools, for example, are present in the archaeological record. So it could be, for example, that tool use, rather sophisticated tool use, originated much earlier than we're able to detect it through stone tools.
Sure. And bamboo in Asia, we have no idea. People might have been using bamboo for all sorts of things, but it wouldn't be in the fossil record.
Right. There's a controversy about whether Homo erectus, which was in Eastern Asia, they appeared not to have for a while people were concluding that they didn't make tools, but it may be simply because they used different materials. And so I would say that it's difficult to draw generalizations about lags and things like that based on what we know about how evolution works and on the evidence that we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one important thing to realize about the way evolution happens is that behavior changes precede anatomical changes. We only see anatomical changes in the fossil record, of course, and then we try to reconstruct or speculate about behavior. But so an example from my own work would be that we found that the chimpanzees we were studying in a forest in Uganda were standing up often in trees to forage. They were doing what we thought only early humans did after they left the trees. And they didn't do this in a dramatic way. They'd do it for a few seconds or a minute at a time. But they would stand on large branches, big fat boughs in the tree, and to reach up and grab fruits that were overhead. And this is not uncommon, but it was the first time anybody really paid attention to it was when my group of researchers did. And this is the kind of behavior that, in theory, could have happened in our earliest pre-human ancestors, that is, ancient apes. And once they'd been doing that for a few thousand generations, and individuals who might have been very good at doing that would have had greater reproductive success. They stand up more often, they're able to forage and harvest more fruit that may increase their nutrition, which leads to more babies. And that way, that trait may become, in a sense, encased in the anatomy. It may become concretized. And then once it has, when that creature, that species moves to the ground, they're already on the way to becoming upright. They don't have to become upright, but they have a pre-adaptation toward moving around in a two-legged posture, which may well have been good for them. So what I'm saying is that behavior precedes anatomy, always, when we look at the evolutionary process.
I'd like to look at that question through one particular lens for a moment, and that's the question of the Neanderthals, because I think most people are aware that the Neanderthals had a big brain, in some cases perhaps slightly larger than our own, that they, obviously they moved out of Africa, their ancestors moved out of Africa before ours did, spread quite widely, and succeeded in quite a wide range. But ultimately, our ancestors left Africa in another wave of emigration and overcame the Neanderthals. And I'm just interested in what your thoughts are about the relationship between brain capacity and evolutionary success, which obviously we have found as Homo sapiens sapiens that ultimately the Neanderthals did not. Michael, do you have any insights into this or
not really?
Stimulating you?
Nothing useful to say, but I'll say it anyway. Well, I think we go back to this idea that we have to break things up into pieces, that if we just look at brain size alone, that doesn't tell us enough. That the brain, in fact, is differentiated. We can distinguish different regions. They may have, to some extent, different functions, but their power comes from the way in which they work together. So you might imagine that the Neanderthal brain might have been better at, let's say, very delicate sensory perception. I think there are some novels in which they had telepathy, right? but unfortunately, they were not skills that could, in the end, beat out Homo sapiens. It may also be that Homo sapiens was just nastier and it wasn't a matter of skill at all. I told you I had nothing useful to say.
I would say I think that the looking at changes in brain size over human evolution is interesting, but I completely agree with Michael that it's limited, and I'm actually a bit of a pessimist about what we can really conclude from brain size. We still don't really understand what the relationship is between absolute number of neurons in the brain, for example, and decomputational
capacities. I'd just like
capacities.
To jump in on this, if I may.
Sure.
Because I think this is where one has to, in some sense, just like Craig was saying, he moved to work on chimpanzees to fill some of the behavioral gaps in the fossil record. So I'm one of these people who looks at comparative neurobiology. John Cass of Vanderbilt University has just edited an incredibly impressive 4-volume work on the evolution of nervous systems, with the 3rd volume on the evolution of mammals and the 4th volume just on the evolution of primates. So that although the fossil record is not going to tell us very much, by seeing how different behaviors that we can observe in modern primates correlate all the way from very simple lemurs in Madagascar to chimpanzees, by correlating those differences with what we really can do in looking at brain function, brain size, but also specialization of different brain areas. I think we're now in a very exciting time of science. And what's happening, of course, that makes an even bigger transition is that now the methods of molecular biology are coming into play. So we can begin to look at the genes and begin to discover that many of the changes are in genes that are not just specialized in the brain, but occur in other parts of the body. And so in some cases, we'll say, aha, this really was an adaptation of the brain to do something specific. And other cases, a bit like the cholesterol story, we'll say, well, this is a quite different system, and yet it has a payoff in terms of the behavioral capabilities of the species.
I agree with that, but I think that the key thing there is being able to look specifically at brain structure and what different parts of the brain mm-hmm. do, for example. There's not a very good a priori reason to think that bigger brains should necessarily be good at anything in particular. What seems to be the case is that what's important for getting the brain to do things is the structure of the brain and the structure of the brain at the neural level. That's the kind of thing that we can't really see. I think in modern humans, we've learned a lot from, and we're learning much, much more now through, for example, neuroscience and studies of what different specialized parts of the brain do. We know things, for example, like, Craig had mentioned earlier, the social intelligence hypothesis. There's been a lot of research suggesting that humans are particularly good at doing things like inferring the intentions of other humans. And there appear to be, Michael may have more to comment on this, but many people think that there's good evidence for specialized brain areas that do that. There's been comparative studies that chimpanzees aren't as good at doing those things. But where I think it really gets interesting is when you actually look at the brain and see that there's actually specialized parts that do it that are particularly well elaborated in humans. And you even have things like disorders in which those kinds of abilities can be relatively selectively lost compared to other kinds of cognitive abilities. So the story gets much more nuanced than simply that our brains are bigger, but rather they have parts that do things that other animals' brains can't do.
I mean, I think it's really important to remember the question, what is the point of having a big, complex brain? And a big, complex brain evolved in humans not because it was advantageous for us to do higher math or have enormous vocabularies or read or write. None of those things, none of those abilities were there or important. And being a hunter-gatherer requires a lot of very high cognitive skills, but reading and writing is not one of them. So that ability is something that arose from the genetic template that was laid down as part of the evolution of our brain. And that's a fascinating topic in itself, because there are abilities. I mean, Einstein would have had no ability to survive in the Pleistocene beyond what any other person living in the Pleistocene already had. So those abilities that we have today arose really in some way in an epigenetic way, meaning they're above and beyond and outside, I think, the genome. What we know is that the purpose, in a Darwinian sense, the purpose of a big, complex brain is to increase the number of surviving offspring that an individual had way back when, thousands of generations ago. That's the Darwinian bottom line that applies to all animal species, including ourselves. And much of what we talk about when we talk about the amazing, glamorous abilities of the modern human brain are aspects and traits that are not necessarily deeply embedded in the original early evolution of the human brain.
Right. In my community on language evolution, this is a point that I keep hammering, and so I've introduced the term the language-ready brain, so that we're saying it's not that the brain evolved to support language. It evolved in the way Craig has described to support many things, which then allowed the discovery of language. It's like saying our brain evolved so we could surf the web. Well, it evolved so that we can surf the web, but I don't think anybody would be crazy enough to say this was an adaptive pressure on the evolution of the human brain.
But surely spoken language is a plausible candidate for something. It's very different than surfing the web, because early humans could have been speaking language. So
But then the point is, were they speaking language, or were they speaking just that they had a more open-ended form of vocal communication? I think there's no doubt that the vocal apparatus and the brain control of the vocal apparatus suggests that better vocal communication was part of the evolutionary pressure, not being able to speak with relative clauses, for example.
Would it be fair to imagine that the increase in the size of the human brain allowed, for example, the development of speech, but then, depending on how individuals mastered that particular ability to speak and to communicate, a particular group which used the same brain in a different way would have an evolutionary advantage? For example, if they could communicate more effectively, they could hunt more effectively, or figure out how to kill the other guys more effectively. That actually, once the brain had reached a certain point, then almost the skill in using the brain became an evolutionary factor. Does that make any sense?
Well, learning to learn is considered to be one of our important skills, that we don't only learn new skills, but when we've learned several skills, then we can better learn other skills. But I wouldn't say our brains are ideal. One of the things that's been changing in recent years is the fuller appreciation of the social aspect of the brain and the integration of that with an understanding of the emotional aspect of the brain. If we have no emotions, we have no drive to do anything. But on the other hand, I occasionally lose my temper, and it's a bad thing when that happens for me. And so one could imagine a creature that can match me in sort of abstract symbolic skills, but has a better integration of the emotional system that would, in some sense, do better. But I think we might later on want to consider more the way in which there is now a technological buffer, which perhaps says we have skills based on our environment that are not inherent within our brain itself. Merlin Donald is one of the people who's given a lot of thought to the evolution of humans. And he makes the point that there's a transition at which we go from relying on our own memory to relying on the memory of the environment. We have, even before we get to symbolic systems, tools in a sense are a memory of skill, that once you've built a tool adapted for a particular purpose, then you pick it up and it helps you remember how to carry out this complicated task rather than using a very generic tool.
Well, actually, the point that you raise there does actually naturally bring us to the next phase of the discussion that I'd like to have, and that is where our brains are going now. Because we've talked about some of the mechanisms which gave us the big brain and some of the uses to which we've put it, which were not its original intended uses. I'm assuming, correct me if I'm wrong, that this absolute size of the human brain has not, since modern humans appeared, actually changed, that we're pretty much with the same size of brain over the last 150, 200,000 years. Do we have any evidence to suggest that the organization of the brain has changed in any way? That the brain functions more effectively, or are there any changes that we know about within the human brain during the modern era in modern human beings?
I think that for the most part, our human gross anatomy, that is the macro structure of our bodies and our soft and hard tissues, have not changed since the origin of modern Homo sapiens, meaning 150,000 or so years ago. It certainly has changed in our genetic composition has changed. It will keep changing. We certainly are evolving. But this is a question students always ask. How are we evolving? What is the future? Am I going to lose my little toe? You know, and in those gross anatomical ways, I don't think we have any evidence for it. Ongoing evolution, and there's nothing to do but speculate when we think about the future. We have no way of knowing what direction evolution goes because it's an historical science, really, involving some of the more micro level, how we respond to the ever presence of viruses, emerging viruses. Our genome will change in big ways, but at a gross level, I don't think that we have changed recently or are changing. I don't know if anybody, Clark, maybe disagrees.
No, I don't disagree with that. I think one of the interesting things that is going on is that since the origins of culture, the brain and culture, in a global sense, have co-evolved so that now we have a brain that is well suited to the acquisition of culture. And culture itself is something which changes over time. It's something that Michael mentioned, and it's not as though we don't know how culture is feeding back on brain evolution at this point. But it's certainly true that what our brains are being used for is quite different than it would have been in many hunter-gatherer societies. So we mentioned the examples of reading and writing. Psychologists and neuroscientists have actually found that those activities structure the brain. They have an effect on structuring the brain so that there are things like automaticity of reading processes and things like that, which mean that cultural phenomenon actually does change brain organization during the lifetime of the individual.
And that's the classic thing that people talk about. If children learn how to play the violin at a young age, there is a part of their brain which functions more effectively, and actually there's more of it.
Exactly, yes. Now, whether then the question that you're asking, which I think we don't know the answer to, is will that lead to a genetic change, a change in the human genome? And that we don't know. The people who do evolutionary models of sort of game theory type of modeling and mathematical modeling of the relationship between genes and culture in human evolution have shown that it's quite likely that the presence of culture actually has led to a fitness benefit, which has changed our genome over long time scales. There's no reason to think that couldn't be happening now, but it's a good question what the changes would be.
I'd like to hit three related topics briefly. The first is that normal human can acquire full human language and any human language. So we feel that the basic brain plan in terms of language and cognition is probably pretty much the same. But we know that skin color seems to have adapted in terms of the amount of exposure to the sun in different parts of the world. We know that there are populations, for example, where delicate trade-offs have been made in the genome so that we have sickle cell anemia is the price that a group has had to pay for having some increased resistance to malaria and so on. So in fact, we do have evidence not of recent selective changes in terms of our cognition, but relatively recent changes in terms of gross anatomy, skin color, genetic composition with respect to disease conditions. So firstly, yes, there have been changes. The second is that we're now entering an amazing stage of knowledge in molecular biology and genetic engineering. And in the future, we're already talking about ways in which genes may be inserted to change people to reduce risks of certain diseases or disorders. But of course, people are already speculating, well, down the line, why not add a gene for improved memory? Why not add a gene for faster locomotion? Whatever your choice is. So that I think that we are about to enter a sort of, if you will, a positive eugenics, where rather than killing off people we regard as defective, we will begin to debate changes that might add qualities, and then we'll get into big debates. Is this something we as a society wish to permit or not? I'm going to go to four items. Item number three is that in the future, then, just as we do have different skin color, different resistance to disease and so on, one may imagine some diversification. There was a book that came out a few years ago. I don't remember the author, but it had wonderful illustrations of people evolve for different conditions. You could imagine one group that wants to return to the trees and evolves better climbing abilities, another group that wants to live in submarine cities and develops gills and things of this kind. So another issue is we always talk as if there is a unity of humankind and there is one evolutionary path for humankind. It may be that our future lies in terms of diverse paths of evolution to adapt for different ecological niches, just in the way we said the primates evolved for different ecological niches. And then the final point is that, of course, a lot of our evolution is now in the technosphere, so that we don't have to rely on a huge memory because we have computers that we know how to use to remember many things for us, and new search engines that let us retrieve that far better than we could otherwise.
I have to, since we're speculating about the future of human evolution, I have to add my one speculation. I have a friend who's an obstetrician, and we were talking recently about cesarean sections. And and the rate of cesarean sections is so high these days and going up rapidly that it led me to think that the one major constraint throughout human history on brain size increase is, of course, skull size. And the skull size constraint is due to the size of a mom's birth canal, in which a baby with too large a head has always died. And that's not the case anymore. So you could actually speculate and say that, and then the C-section rate is up to 25 or 30% in many hospitals, at least in the West.
So we're going to evolve the Velcro birth
canal? You could imagine our babies being born with significantly larger brains. And a large brain doesn't always mean a complex, high-functioning brain, but it suggests that it would. So I think you could actually speculate that there would be a very significant cognitive change in the next couple of centuries, even if all of a sudden being a big, big-brained baby was not fatal, which is what it's always been throughout human history until just basically this decade.
One thing that you actually mentioned before is that the key currency is fitness. So if we're talking about biological evolution, for a trait like larger brains to evolve, it's true that things like reducing mortality through technologies like cesarean section might allow for larger brains. But then the question is, would people with those larger brains actually have more offspring or higher fitness? That would be the prerequisite for biological evolution to happen. And one of the things that's interesting about modern technology is that we know of many cases where human bodies and minds appear to be poorly adapted, if you will, in certain ways to modern environments. So there's probably, people have speculated that there's greater prevalence of things like depression now than there are in traditional societies due to certain features about the way that we live, our hectic lifestyles and things like that, that in principle could be a source of selection. However, if we have interventions like antidepressant medicines, for example.
Or indeed genetic modifications for cheerfulness.
Or genetic modifications, that may actually remove that would actually serve to sort of decrease the strength of selection. So we may end up in a situation where we are, in fact, able to mitigate some of these maladaptive features that we have. Also things like the effects of cholesterol through genetic engineering of food and things like that, where, I mean, we do appear to be maladapted in certain ways, but it may be that we actually, that's not fixed through natural selection, right? It may be that it's actually fixed through technological evolution that fixes the problem, and instead of the problem being fixed through differential mortality, which would be what would happen if natural selection were to take care of it.
Because the fascinating thing about what you've been saying is that, in effect, we are finding ourselves technologically in the position to start consciously changing the nature of human evolution, the brain among other organs, that in effect it's that process is coming into our hands depending on what we want to do with it.
Actually, what we're doing is we're relaxing selection. These examples we just gave really were basically examples of how natural selection would not be operating on the human species. Babies would no longer die because their body size was too big for their mom to deliver them, and some of the technological advances that Clark just mentioned. So in a sense, I'm not sure what it would lead the human species to look like, but it would mean that we would be a kinder, gentler species in terms of many more individuals surviving positive eugenics, as we said earlier. That is clearly the present and future for any technological population in our species.
Well, I'm sure that the listeners will feel that if we do manage to find a way of evolving into a kinder, gentler species, that will be a major step forward. Clark Barrett, Craig Stanford, Michael Arby, thank you all very much indeed.